Okay, today is April 16th, 2013. I am Sarah Hunter-Laskowski here with Hillary Domisch. We're interviewing Chris Emke here at his house in New Mexico. And as we mentioned, we usually start at the beginning of your life. And we know that you were born in Minneapolis in 1933. But other than that, what was it like growing up? What was your childhood like in Minneapolis?
I was a Depression baby because the Depression was hard going on. I interrupted my parents' college ambitions by happening, and so my dad, who was going to be an electrical engineer, ended up repairing radios. And then got a job at Dunwoody Industrial Institute in Minneapolis, trade school. And I lived in various houses around in Minneapolis. I guess, it was just a sort of middle class family. Not upper middle class, definitely. So, and my parents hadn't finished college. Growing up in Minneapolis was wonderful. I remember walking everywhere. I remember, just going out on my own. I was an only child. I had had a lot of friends, spent a lot of time at the library, loved reading, had tons of hobbies, and also got interested in electronics, I think, through my dad. And while I was taking high school, while I was in high school, I took electronics courses at Dunwoody, because sometimes he'd be teaching night classes, and I would go there and take a class, and then we'd go home together. And so I got an early training in electronics, and loved science. Shy. But I did well in science classes, not so well in non-science classes, and had plenty of interests and friends. I was on the stage crew, I was stage manager in high school, which was fun. It was a lot of fun.
So did you build a stage manager? Did you have to help build sets and things like that? Or?
Yeah, build sets and set things up and things, but that was all pretty well. It's amazing. I don't think high school students anymore. They had regular sets in the basement, and this was done like a regular stage. You screwed the sets to the floor, and
wow.
And it was very interesting. And so I played the piano and I think had really a very full life.
It sounds really busy and fun.
It was busy and fun. I'm still busy and fun. It's there's always more to do than there is time for, and I enjoy that.
What did your mom do? Did she work outside of the home?
My mom was was a clerk at Dayton's. Which has become sort of branched off into Target on the one hand and Marshall Fields on the other. was a big department store. My dad got involved in, then of course the Second World War came along, and then my dad got involved in, he wasn't able to serve, but he got involved in technical developments during the Second World War, particularly bomb sites for bombers and things like that. So, and then he went overseas a couple of times to set up electronic training institutes in Korea, which didn't work because then the Korean War started, and Indonesia. But by that time, I was off.
So when it came time
when you were in high school, when it came time to figure out about going to college, was it kind of a foregone conclusion that you would go to college? As you said, you interrupted your parents' college ambition.
Yeah.
By showing up. So was it expected that you would go to college?
Yes. Yes. It was expected that I would go to college. I think I've been driven by a desire to be a teacher as long as I can remember. And so when I was in the high school environment, I realized you had to go to college in order to teach high school, which is, of course, what I wanted to do. And then I got to college, I realized you had to go to graduate school in order to teach college, which is, of course, what I wanted to do. And so, yeah, that just kept pushing the education along. Really was driven by my interest in teaching. And that's never changed. So, yeah.
Were there any teachers in high school that you maybe wanted to model yourself after, or were particularly interesting or inspiring? Or
yeah, I went to Central High School. It was not in the best neighborhood in town at that time, and it didn't. The people there didn't have the highest ambitions, I think, for the students that they had. So, nevertheless, there were a few standout teachers. I don't remember my chemistry teacher for inspiring me as much as scaring me. But I think that I remember a geometry teacher, and there were I took a sort of special college-oriented literature and history series, and they were taught by a couple of women I still remember, who were very very encouraging, extremely encouraging to me. Now I don't think. I don't know. The chemistry teacher was doing a section on oxygen, on hydrogen, sorry. And so she had a Kipp generator going up there, and she was making these little bottles of hydrogen, and she asked people what would happen if hydrogen burned. And I figured out that would be hydrogen oxide. Oh my gosh, that's water. So, you know. And everybody laughed when I suggested that, because then the water put the fire out. So then I said, well, you could hold a glass plate over the flame and see if you got condensation. So she said, well, okay, why don't you come down and do that? So she wants me to burn hydrogen at the lecture desk. So we ended up with an explosion.
Yeah.
Which fortunately just drove the cork with its glass stopper, which is a glass tube, which I put in there to mount the flame on, up into the ceiling. Anyway, interesting introduction to chemistry.
A memorable one.
I wasn't particularly attracted to chemistry in high school. I love physics, math. And it really wasn't until my junior year in college that I decided where I was going to head.
When it came time to pick a college, what were you looking for? You know, did your parents have any input in that decision?
Yeah, they did. But, you know, I just was talking with a kid that I grew up with out in the country, and he went to Hopkins High School, and Hopkins High School had a lot of bright people, and so on. He went to Yale. Nobody ever in the world thought of the possibility of going out of state, much less some prestigious place. I mean, it was just sort of pretty much out of the question. So I was planning to go to the University of Minnesota, just like all good Minneapolis kids do. and or did. And then I went to a presentation of Principia College gave, and ended up just being dazzled by it. It's beautiful little campus, you know, with these great little limes, not just absolutely picture perfect, on the bluffs of the Mississippi River, you know, in southern Illinois. And I was pretty idealistic. And Principia College is a school for Christian Science. And I was very deeply into Christian Science. And so I thought this would be just perfect. But you see, they didn't have a program in electrical engineering. So what I could do is I could take sort of a pre-engineering program for a couple of years and then transfer. That's what I was going to do. So off I went. I got a scholarship, which made it financially possible, and got jobs while I was there. And that was the choice. It wasn't made on any solid academic concerns or anything like that.
Were your parents concerned about you going so far away? I mean, you had been planning to stay in Minneapolis and go to University of Minnesota.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. I think they were happy for me. Yeah.
How far away was it for you to get to Principia?
Well, it's in Illinois, just across the river from St. Louis.
Okay.
Okay.
So a little ways
it's
away.
It's a ways. It's definitely a ways. It's two train rides.
So when you got there, you know, what was the program like? Was it what you were expecting?
I had no idea what to expect. And I was taking, it was sort of on what was called the Dartmouth plan at that time. You took three courses solid. We don't do that anymore, right? We take two credit courses and three credit courses and load them up until you get to 15. These were all five credit courses, basically. And it was on a quarter system. So you had 10, 12 weeks of 5 days a week of each of your three courses. And then I had, because in order to do the pre-engineering thing, I had a half course on top of that of drafting or something that was related to engineering. And so, chemistry, physics, and math. Solid.
Was it interesting once you got there? Were the classes...
Small
I mean, were
college,
they
400 students total?
Wow!
Total. I had more people in my graduating class in high school than there were in the whole college. Everybody knew everybody. It was a lovely environment, really. It really was. Yeah.
So, how many people were in your chemistry classes or in your drafting class?
I was in the drafting class, and alone.
Alone. Okay.
I was the drafting class, as I might have put it. Yes, no one else was doing that. And I think they were surprised they even had it in the catalog, actually. Classes were 20 people.
You said that it was a college that was a Christian Scientist
right.
College.
Yes.
So did you have to take also classes on religion or
no.
or anything
no.
related to
Actually,
that?
No, they didn't teach Christian Science. It was just an environment which was totally Christian Scientist, even the faculty.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, still is.
Hmm. Now, you said your intention had been to transfer.
That didn't happen.
Yes. So what happened that made you stay?
Well, a couple things happened. One was that after my freshman year, I was so saturated with chemistry, physics, and math, and I love science, and I knew that's what I wanted to do, but suddenly, here I was in a liberal arts college getting zero liberal arts. And And of course, I met somebody. And so my sophomore year, I didn't take any science classes at all. None. Maybe math. I don't remember now exactly. But I just said, I've had it somehow or another. I had this little revolt, I guess. And I took comparative literature and philosophy, and I just did what I should have done, actually, in that environment. Thank goodness. But that meant I didn't take organic chemistry. And so when I got back on the science track my junior year, well, and then I was no longer fit to go to the University of Minnesota and transfer in as a junior, and I'd kind of lost my interest in engineering by that time. I realized there was something really great in the solid sciences. And so so I stayed at Principia and graduated.
So then junior year, did you have to kind of double up to finish the sciences?
Not really. I never did take organic chemistry.
Oh, no.
Well, until I got to graduate school. So, so they didn't know quite what to do with me about that. What was my degree exactly? So I guess I got a Bachelor of Arts. But I got to graduate school.
Mm-hmm. You said, though, that junior year in college was when you really decided that chemistry, as opposed to some of the other sciences or as opposed to the engineering, was what you wanted.
Yeah. Have you ever thought back about those points in your life when you made decisions that made your life go this way or that way?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've thought a lot about those, and I've thought a lot about the reasons that I had when I made, why I made those decisions. Hardly any of the reasons that I had at the time for making the decisions had anything to do with whether the decision was good or bad. Try that sometime. It's really, really interesting. Why did I decide to do that? Well, wasn't that irrelevant? You know? It's really. So at any rate, I knew that I wanted to teach. Again, that was the overriding thing. I was going to teach college. Oh, if I could come to a nice little college like this and teach, wouldn't that be wonderful? So I was going to teach physics or chemistry or math. But by that time, I'd really kind of gotten a little bite of research and really thought that was fun. And not only was it fun, it was enlivening. It made the science come alive. And math by that time was beginning to get a little abstract. And physics, this was the time now when it seemed like the only thing that was really going on in physics was nuclear. And the physics prof there was doing a little research, and what he was doing was he was analyzing plates that had been exposed to cosmic rays from a balloon. And having been held, and that was all he could do. And he had done his graduate work where they had an accelerator, and that was. And I thought, I don't think I want to have to be where there's an accelerator in order to do my work. So I thought, well, chemistry will be it. Then, beginning of my junior year, it was the summer between my junior and senior year. My chemistry teacher, prof, hired me to work over the summer on an electroplating project that he had. And all of a sudden, here was chemistry and electronics.
Mm-hmm.
And it just came smack together, and I said, yes, this is it. I'm an electrochemist. So that's what I did, and then that's got me involved in electric chemistry, and I thought that's just a perfect match.
Were you able in the junior or senior year to continue to take any of those kind of liberal arts courses that you've sophomore year?
Yes, I did continue. I took 2 years of Spanish and I did continue to take liberal arts classes, yeah.
What about some of the hobbies that you talked about in high school? Were you able to continue any of those?
Not really. I tried to continue the piano, but there really wasn't space and time for that. And so that fell away. Photography, I kept an interest in. No.
Now, obviously, you know, research is also something you want to do. So you're getting started thinking about graduate school, and
yes.
We know that you stayed in Illinois. But were there particular professors or types of research or things you were looking at to kind of push you to Illinois?
No. Yes and no. I shouldn't say no. There definitely was. I had an opportunity to sort of interview at MIT, and I understood that talking with the students there, they didn't get enough money for their teaching assistantship to support them. And my family had already sacrificed quite enough to get me as far as I was. And I understood that there were places where you could go and be self-supporting. And meantime, my chemistry prof had in fact just completed his doctorate working with an inorganic chemist and an analytical chemist at the University of Illinois. And that was Herb Lightman, was the analytical chemist. And he really thought that it would be good for me to go and work with Herb Lightman. So I guess he primed Herb to do that, to set me up for that. And so I interviewed at Illinois as well. I applied a few other places. I applied at Harvard, and they referred me to Radcliffe because of my name. This happens all the time. And so, just for stupid little reasons, you know, I ended up eliminating one after the other. When I went to interview at Illinois, Herb Lightman just took me in.
Now, did you apply to University of Minnesota? Did you consider going back, kind of back home?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember now whether I did live or not. Could have done.
But by the time you got to visit Illinois, you met Herb Lightman, and he
offered me a summer job before starting graduate school, and that just made life easy. All of a sudden, it didn't matter what else happened. That's what I was going to do. Yeah, so. So that was really fun. That was really fun. I was assigned to one of his graduate students, who was trying to measure the double air capacity of a mercury drop, and the drop is growing, and what's happening is organic chemicals in the solution are being adsorbed on that drop, so that's changing the double air capacitance because it's putting in a more dielectric between the electrode and the solution. And so the question was how to catch this. Mm-hmm. And so I devised an impedance measurement device that you could tune up that would come to balance at various times in the drop growth, so he could catch it at any time that he wanted to and plot the whole thing out. It made his thesis, really, and it was fun for me because it was electronics, and so that was, suddenly I was just in my milieu, and I took German, probably. In those days, you needed to be able to read technical German and French.
And French.
Right. And of course, I've taken Spanish, so
right.
Here I am. Yeah. So I took, they had courses, particularly for people who just needed to know how to read technical German and French. So I started that, and so I was taking these language courses and preparing for exams. And now, of course, I don't have organic chemistry. My physical chemistry wasn't good enough. So I was taking, when I started there, I was taking remedial physical chemistry, undergraduate organic chemistry, and I had to have a full load of graduate classes.
In addition to that,
in order to avoid, in order to keep my deferment from the Korean War. And I needed to teach in order to support myself. I was busy. It was probably the hardest year academically I've ever had.
Was the deferment from the Korean War something that was easy to acquire as long as you were taking the full load of courses? How did that work?
There was an exam that you had to take that showed that you were fit for graduate work. You were on an intellectual level that you could do graduate work. But if you could do that and you maintained a total full load of graduate work, then you could be different, right? Mm-hmm.
So in the midst of this very busy and difficult first year, how are you finding the teaching part of it?
Oh gosh, I love teaching.
Even right away?
Oh, absolutely right away. Yeah. Yeah, it was great. And it was teaching the quantitative analysis lab. And I did that for a year. Then Howard Malmsteen had tried to teach. Howard Malmsteen was a young faculty member at the University of Illinois at that time. And he had also an interest in electronics. He had been in the Navy, and he'd gone to Navy Radar School, and he'd come back and got his PhD at Wisconsin doing conductivity, conductometric titrations, actually, which nobody does anymore, using high frequency signals instead of DC. Mm-hmm. So, or low frequency AC. And so so he was electronically oriented, and he could see that electronics were becoming really important. Instrumentation was just beginning to come on, and he had this incredible vision about chemical instrumentation. And so he wanted to teach electronics to the graduate students, and he tried a lecture class, and it just didn't work. And so he realized that he was going to need to have a laboratory, and he needed a teaching assistant, and he needed experiments. And so he recruited me to be the teaching assistant for this class, and to help work with him to devise some experimental setup that would allow us to teach the electronics. And that got me busy. Because every week we tried something that didn't work as well as it ought to, and the next week we had to try something else. And I was there day and night, pretty much.
Did you have any, I have friends who are chemistry professors now, and when their department devises a new laboratory for the students, they kind of take a semester or take the summer months to kind of plan it all and make sure, that they have enough experiments or have the prep work done. Did you guys have any lead time like that where you could kind of...
I remember. No,
just
he,
dove
was
right
just,
in?
He was just a dive right in kind of person. And we worked it out. By the third or fourth week, we had something that was going to carry us through the rest of the term. The typical way to teach electronics those days was to have all the components that you were going to use, the vacuum tubes and the resistors and everything, screwed down to a piece of plywood. And then you would connect these components with wires.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit hokey in a way, because A, you can only do one thing. And then if you want to do another thing, you get another whole board.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't as efficient as what we needed to do. And so we ended up creating something that you could not have to solder wire everything together in order to make whatever you wanted to make.
So you worked with Howard Malmstadt then throughout your time at Illinois in this laboratory?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. And did you have to do any other teaching? Did you ever go back to teaching the quantitative laboratory?
I taught in that class. He was gone a lot. I'd take over the lectures. It was great. Yeah. And I tutored.
Okay.
Students. But no, I didn't go back to teaching the quantum. I taught that electronics. Wait a minute. Because I was only taught one term a year, it wasn't taught every term, and so, of course, in the terms in between, I was doing something else.
What was the student interest like in this kind of new electronics lab and course?
That's a nice question, Sarah. I think the student, well, they were graduate students. It was a graduate class. And the student interest was pretty high. It was pretty high. That was at a time, you know, when people wanted to hook recorders up to their experiments so they could get a record of what happened, and sensors were just coming on. Oscilloscopes were just becoming something that was a general purpose laboratory tool. But how do you use them? How do you get your experiment hooked up to these new devices? And I think that people really, really realized that this was where things were going, and this was the way to get there. And that turned out to be true, because the course spread and it was very popular in physics and chemistry departments all over the country.
Now, when you guys started with this class and figuring out the laboratory,
mm-hmm.
were other colleges and universities, did they have similar classes, or was this really something kind of brand new?
I think it was pretty new. I think it was, in fact, brand new. In order to really learn electronics at greater depth, I took classes in the physics department. Of electronics, but they were just lectures again, and so I learned an awful lot now about not just practical electronics, but really the fundamentals of electronics. And in order to do that, see, and this was the barrier. In order to take the electronics classes in physics, I had to take electricity and magnetism. In order to take electricity and magnetism, I had to take differential equations, and so I had to go through all these prerequisites in order to take two semesters of electronics in the physics department. Now, this is getting to be more than a minor, actually.
Yeah.
And so that was a big barrier. And the physics department, I chose the physics department to do this in because EE was even worse before you could get to anything practical. Any useful level things. And so there really wasn't a mechanism for students who just wanted to use some electronics to get some practical electronics and to get it in a condensed enough form so that it didn't become a whole subtopic rather.
So then for the laboratory course, did you guys have prerequisites that students needed to take? I mean, did they need differential equations? Did they need... Okay.
No. They needed an undergraduate degree in science. Yeah.
And the interest.
And the interest, right.
Now, the whole time that you're devising these laboratory experiments on instrumentation, you're continuing your graduate research with Herb Leitman, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how did the research go?
I love the research. It he put me on a problem. He taught me something, right? I had so many embarrassing moments with Herb, but one of them was... I'm sort of getting in towards the end of my first year, the beginning of the second year. He calls me into his office and he says, "Well, Chris, what do you want to do for your research? What kind of things are you interested in?" Well, I had done some reading, and and so I said, "I'd really like to do something along a pretty fundamental line, fundamental electrochemistry." Like that fellow, I said, and he had arranged electrodes with different barriers, and so we could study the diffusion through different shapes on the way to the electrode. And so I said, "I thought that was really neat. I'd like to do something sort of like that." And he said, "Well, that was my thesis. Now, what's yours going to be?" Just one of those moments. Why didn't I know that was his? Because at the time I was in college, I wasn't paying any attention to who did what.
Right.
So that was embarrassing. That was seriously embarrassing. But at any rate, got the idea. So I was studying. Platinum electrodes were considered to be inert, but at the same time, something was going on the platinum surface when you used it into the anodic and cathodic range, over its full anodic and cathodic range. And the suspicion was that there was a layer of oxide, just a monolayer of oxide being formed on the positive end. And so, so that was what I was trying to do, was to unravel what was going on the platinum surface. The amount of electricity that goes to forming just one oxide layer on top of one square centimeter of platinum is not very much. Okay. And so it was it was electrically challenging in order to do this. And one of the exciting things was that in the aftermath of the Second World War, it turns out that one of the big electronic developments were operational amplifiers. And operational amplifiers are still huge, but we just don't talk about them anymore because digital computing has taken over everything. But these were the building blocks of analog computers. Now they're the building blocks of all analog electrical circuits. From amplifiers to radios, you name it. It's all of everything you see in any electrical instrument has got operational amplifiers in it. It's tremendous. But they were just coming on, and I was fascinated by them, and it turns out that you could measure tiny, they would allow you to measure tiny quantities of electricity, tiny currents, tiny charges. And so I got Herb to get me some, and we built the power supply to run them because that was too expensive. So I was one of the first people to employ operational amplifiers in analytical instrumentation.
When you told Herb that you wanted to do that, was he interested or excited? I mean, obviously he said yes ultimately,
yeah.
but
It wasn't ultimately. I don't even remember having an argument about it.
Okay.
I just, you know, it was, look, I think this would work. I think this would be just fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was he...
Think about it. He trusted me. It was fun. Yeah.
Was he an advisor that was easy to talk to and easy to work with?
He was a reserved Northern Minnesotan Finn. It was not easy to talk to. I would never say we had a personal relationship, even though I really think that we liked each other. So it's kind of strange, isn't it? But he just had this. He had this reserve. He had an interesting sense of humor, but I can't remember a time when I was able to really have any kind of a deep conversation with him about anything. Even though there were a couple times when I needed to and tried, I wasn't there. But an astute advisor, the person who gave me my run, smart, oh my gosh, intuitive sense. We would get in our group meetings on Friday afternoons, and somebody would tell about an experiment that he had done. He said, "No, do it again." He just knew what made sense to him. If it fit intuitively into what it is he imagined was going to be going on, and then that was fine. He told me that once too, I said, man. And he was absolutely right. I went back and I realized I was trying to make a constant current source of the big resistor, but the electrochemical component was bigger still, so in resistance. And so it was limiting the current, and I didn't have a constant current source for what I was trying to do. So he sensed that. He just, no. So... Yeah, he was a model in a lot of ways. but I was very, very lucky to have that relationship with her, with Howard Malmsteen at the mm-hmm. same time. I really had two mentors. I had a teaching mentor and I had a research mentor. I don't know if many people have a chance to do that. And think about it. When I think about it today, I don't think I know of anybody, and I think I would have a hard time myself letting a graduate student go as much as Herb let me go in the work that I was doing with her. Because these days, when you have to support a graduate student and you have to get two or three papers a year out of that graduate student in order to have a grant that's supporting and continue and so on, you can't afford to let students have that kind of side experience
right.
on the side. How incredibly enriching it was for me and how totally impossible it would be today.
Now, did Howard have his own research group?
Oh, yeah. Oh, didn't he? Yes. He had a huge research group.
Okay.
He graduated people that that went on to populate analytical departments, analytical faculty and chemistry departments all over the country. I'm working with one now. Yeah. And they very graciously sort of allowed me into the Malmsteen alumni group as well. So,
when, you know, as you're moving on in your career at University of Illinois, and, you know, you have kind of these two parallel experiences. You have these two advisors, you have the research advisor and the research with Herb Layton, and you have kind of the teaching and the research to make the laboratory experiments work with Howard Malmsteen. How do you know when you're done and when you're ready to leave, since you do have so much going on?
That's a really good question, isn't it? And that's still a complicated question for graduate students, I think, even more and more. And I think I left before most research advisors today would have, or probably even should have, let me go. I hadn't written the paper up on my thesis research when I left. And it was just one paper. So, but we did get done, and it was good. So, yeah.
Were other people at that time getting more papers than just the one?
No, it was a different time.
Okay.
It was a different time. Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't that I was really letting the side down. But it wasn't good training for me, in a sense, for a future career, because I needed to learn myself to become way more paper-oriented than I was at the time that I left graduate school.
Did you publish anything with Howard? I mean, I know ultimately you guys went on to write a book.
Yes.
But I'm not exactly sure when you wrote that, if you wrote that when you were at Illinois or if you wrote it together later.
We wrote it together later, and we did write a paper. on the class itself. Let's see. Analytical Cambay Pages paper in 1961. Electronics and Instrumentation and Chemical Research. Yes, but then we did go on to write a book, and more importantly, I think, or as importantly as part of that, was that Howard realized that you really had to make the barrier for adoption of this as low as possible, and he also knew from his experience that if people tried to do it as just a lecture course, it wasn't going to work, and so we needed this. There needed to be an inexpensive, available source for the equipment, the method of connectors and the assembly of parts and power supply and all of that sort of thing that we had, oscilloscope and what have you. We needed that needed to be available to people to put into their own labs at the minimum of fuss. And so we went to the Heath Company. Benton Harbor, Michigan, they made Heath kits. And they had never produced finished stuff. But they did have, in kit form, some of the test equipment that we needed, and we actually were using. And they had the assembly line to produce this, and they had a low-cost mentality along with it, and they were well-known. And so we got them to build the Malmsted Encke lab station. And so they did. And that's what made it possible. It was a box that, with doors that opened in front. It sat on top of a double pedestal desk. And students sat there and they had everything that they needed to do, the full range of electronics and measurement experiments for a whole semester. So that was, and that was a really, really, really important part of this, because then all of a sudden people could say, yeah, we can do this, and make this investment in time and this investment in space. Take this book, the experiments are all there, the text is all there, just do it. physics departments were among the first to adopt. Because they knew that they needed electronics. Their students needed electronics.
Right.
So
chemistry departments were a little bit slower?
Yes, they were, but not by much.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't know if it's something maybe people today think about. You know, today electronics and every single thing you have in your home, every device is meant for convenience. And, you know,
yes,
we typically think about, you know, instrumentation and everything from that era as being, you know, big and bulky and very expensive. And, you know, here's something that is kind of changing the game a little bit in terms of how we might think of this.
It changed the game in terms of research because it gave the full power of electronic measurement devices coming out of the Second World War available to people doing laboratory experiments. It allowed them to devise their own, essentially, custom instrumentation measurement systems. And then that was a big job for us over the next 15 years, because along came transistors and then integrated circuits and so on. The operational amplifiers went from being a pair of vacuum tubes and a thing about this size down to a little integrated circuit this size. and we had to shepherd keep the course up to date and the books up to date to the experiments and the lab stations. So the company kept up with that too, and we devised ways of making increasingly complex systems out of the increasingly powerful electronics.
Now the relationship at the very beginning with Heath Company, I mean, they were making Heath kits and people knew of them, but did you or Howard have any relationship with them? Did you?
Oh, I was an avid customer. I built so many Heath kits. I don't yeah. But no, we hadn't. But this appealed to them. That it was privately owned. And I think that the owner, what appealed to the owner was the possibility of having a line that was, this would bring some prestige to the company, and I think he liked that idea. So we didn't, it wasn't too hard to sell, I think. We had several meetings up there, and they assigned us an engineer to put together the package of the devices that we needed.
And what was that transition like? I mean, as you're finishing up your PhD, you're ready to kind of move on to your own full-time position, and meanwhile, you're also developing, you know, the Heath kits. You know, what was that kind of balance and transition like as you're moving on to your career as well?
Well, the textbook and the Heath kit thing came while I was trying to make my way as an academic on my first academic job. So I felt that it was something very important to do. So, but I also didn't neglect the teaching and the research that I had to set up to at that job. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to dovetail in. You know, I don't think that the senior faculty, my first teaching job was at Princeton, and I don't think the senior faculty there, they were of two minds. One was telling me that this was really not good for me to be doing and was not going to help my career. And another one was telling me that I really needed to teach electronics by having students construct their own vacuum tubes. And I mean, literally. So I wasn't getting a lot of support from that environment. I'm glad that I persisted with it, though, because I still got a lot of research done, and I had good students, some really good students. Keeping in touch with them today still. So And I don't think that it really would have made any difference in the end at Princeton whether I had or hadn't done this book and course and things like that.
But how,
go ahead.
How was the teaching generally? I mean, you had said, you know, you always kind of, you wanted to teach, you had this desire to teach,
yeah.
And now at Princeton, you're in charge of your own classes. You know, did you feel excited and free to teach as you wanted, or did you feel hampered because, you know, you were getting these kind of two different attitudes about how to teach instrumentation, how to do electronics, and all of that?
Well, I wasn't teaching electronics at first, and so I was just teaching. When I got there, there were three other analytical chemists. One had been there for 7 years and had just been let go, which should have taught me something like that. And the other was Clark Bricker and N. Howell Furman. N. Howell Furman was just a luminary. He's in all the history of analytical chemistry things. You know, he was the mentor of Charlie Riley and Buzz Adams and he was a great gentleman, just absolutely terrific. But he was getting very near retirement. Clark Bricker was one of his students. and was really a tremendous teacher. So in terms of mentoring, you know, how to teach, how to engage students and that sort of thing, Clark Bricker was really great.
No, I'm sorry, did you say he was the one who had just been let go, or was he?
No, would let go, the fellow who had been let go, no, I'm trying to remember, I can't remember his name.
Because Clark Bricker didn't stay at Princeton, he went.
You're quite right about that. And so, 2 years after I got there, Furman retired and Bricker left for Kansas. And suddenly I was the analytical chemistry professor, teacher, actually instructor. They decided they couldn't have an instructor running a division, so they made me an assistant professor. And I had two undergraduate classes and two graduate classes. We were trying to get some more help. Yeah. So it was very demanding. I had a very heavy teaching load there in an area that turned out really not, it was to be an area they didn't want.
Right. Aside from the teaching and the difficulties of Princeton, what was the move to the East Coast like? I mean, you'd been in the Midwest,
right,
for your life and for your education, and you made this big move to the East Coast.
Yes.
So, what was your impression of it? I mean, other than the trip to MIT, where perhaps you learned that MIT was not going to be the right place for you for graduate school.
Right. Well, Princeton was kind of a dazzle, you know. It was just the faculty at Princeton. This is really something. but I was soon. It was soon became very clear to me that I wasn't going to really belong there for a long, long time, either in the town or on the faculty. I don't know, one of the organic chemists shortly after I'd arrived asked me how I liked it there, and I bubbled all over the place, and he said, well, Inga, pronouncing my name with the correct German pronunciation. He said, well, I don't get to liking it too much. So
they really rolled out the welcome wagon, huh?
Yeah, I really, really rolled it out. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it was a place where I kind of joke about it. I'd say I learned a whole new meaning of the word critical faculty. It was a rough place, very competitive. These were the days of one-upsmanship, and they had it down to a T. So it was one of the most stratified environments I've ever been in. And there was a physical chemist on the faculty there. And people asked him where he did his work. He'd say Cambridge, hoping that they would think Cambridge, England. But when they'd say, oh, Cambridge, England? He'd say, no, Cambridge, Mass. Hoping they'd think it was Harvard. And when they say, oh, Harvard, then he'd say, well, MIT. So here was a person having to sort of hide that he had just only graduated from MIT with his degree. And here I am from Champaign-Urbana, right? I mean, you can see how it was going.
When you had been at University of Illinois, was the atmosphere that you could observe both amongst the professors and with your fellow graduate students, was it more collegial than competitive? I mean, you said when you got to Princeton, it was kind of the most competitive that you had seen.
You know, I didn't experience any of this competitiveness.
Okay.
But I wasn't. It's probably due to an incredible level of naivete that I've managed to carry with me for a long time. And because subsequently I learned about some of the tensions and problems that Herb was having and Howard was having with the other faculty that are dealing with it. I was not aware of that at all. So this was quite a shock to suddenly come in. And we got Herb to come and give a talk, and he came and gave his talk, and I'm driving him back to the Newark Airport from Princeton, and I tried to engage him on this topic. What is it about analytical chemistry? What's happening here? And he didn't want to talk about it. I was really hurting and trying to sort it out, but he wasn't going to engage. So that was one of those examples of where I really needed, you know, to have a heart to heart, but I couldn't get it.
When you left University of Illinois for Princeton, were there other opportunities that you could have taken?
Yeah, I had an offer open from. Cornell.
Okay.
And I had an NSF postdoc to go to Stuttgart. Yeah.
How did you decide to go to Princeton over Cornell or Stuttgart?
I liked, Princeton seemed like an easier environment than Cornell. The possibility of going to either one of those straight out without the postdoc sounded good at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Again, one of those decision points you think, well, can we review the bidding? But, and I think it didn't hurt that my wife's brother had graduated from Princeton, and this was kind of a dazzled environment for her, too. So, yeah, that's not my current wife we're talking about, but the one that
When did you get married?
And I got married in graduate school, second year. Yeah, 1956.
Busy time.
Yes, right. I went into Herb and I said, Herb, I'm going to get married this summer. Just looked at me. So I didn't know what to say. He just looked at me like, why are you telling me? And so I said, well, I'm trying to think of something like that. I said, well, I'm hoping this won't affect my work particularly or whatever. And he said, never knew anyone had helped.
So again, not the real heart-to-heart kind of eyes.
Not your warm fuzzy. Yeah. Not your warm fuzzy. Yeah.
I'm curious, while you were at Princeton, if it was difficult to maintain the relationship and the collaboration with Howard. I mean, now,
yeah.
You know, maintaining a collaboration like that, in theory, is so much easier because you can jot off an email, someone can read it, you know, in a matter of minutes or not, depending on what time zone they're in, and in some ways that's so easy. How difficult was it at the time, or was it not difficult?
Well, it sure wasn't as easy as it would have been today. I had just a year ago, I had an intense collaboration with a fellow in Belgium that I'd never met before. And so we did it by Skype.
Oh.
You know, an email. It was amazing. So, of course, we had to do all this by mail and phone, but I would make frequent trips out to Michigan.
To meet him at Heath, or?
To meet him at Heath. Well, he had a house on Lake Michigan, not very far from Benton Harbor, and so I would go there and stay, and we'd work, and go to Heath, and do stuff, and so in a few days we could get a lot done. And sometimes I'd go to Champaign, Urbana, to his house there.
Now, while you were at Princeton, you mentioned it was this incredibly competitive, stratified environment, and you know, maybe it was the first time you had noticed this kind of environment in an academic setting. How did that affect your ability to work and juggle these things? Was it something that you tried to kind of not be a part of, or was it something that had an effect on the things you were doing?
I think my response to that kind of thing was just to kind of pull in and do my thing myself and hope it turned out. I couldn't change my credentials, so there was no way to really try to get into that game.
Did you find it was something that other faculty members kind of wanted to make a big deal out of?
It seemed to be part of the environment. There were a few notable people who were just not that way that I was able to be friends with. Ted Taylor, an organic chemist, and a few others. Right, but it was lonely.
How were the students? I mean, you said there are some of them that you're still in touch with, and that your students were very good. Did they also feel this competitiveness, or did they seem to, as students at least, kind of work well with each other and have that more collegial atmosphere?
I don't really know. Whether they were part of that competitive life or not, I guess it's I really don't have a feeling for that.
That's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. You mentioned that...
It was an all-boys school at that time.
Yes.
Yeah. I sat in a faculty meeting where they were trying to decide whether it would be okay to have women graduate students or not.
Huh.
Over in Nassau Hall. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what these guys were saying. I mean, I had gone to co-ed schools all my life. What was the problem?
Was Principia all? Was Principia co-ed then?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, absolutely. And so,
but they weren't there yet at Princeton necessarily.
Oh no. These things. Why it wouldn't work? And you know. And
I don't think Princeton allowed female undergrads until about 1969.
I think that's right.
They were really late.
Yeah, because the. If I remember correctly, they were the last Ivy League to allow women, and undergraduates at least.
Mm-hmm. I would totally believe that.
I'd have to double check, but that's my recollection.
Yeah. The women graduate students weren't going to get jobs, they weren't going to hold jobs, they were going to, you know, leave partway through their degree, they were going, you know, it was just...
Had there been any women in your graduate program at the University of Illinois?
Oh gosh, yes.
Oh gosh,
sure. Yeah.
How about either in the Malmstadt group or in the Leighton group?
Yes. Yeah, they were. Not so many as came later, but yeah, they were, and there were quite a few in the organic and inorganic areas.
You mentioned that after a couple years at Princeton, you started to realize that Princeton, aside from being intensely competitive, didn't necessarily care that much about analytical chemistry, if I was understanding you correctly. And I'm curious if you were noticing anything or if there was any sort of larger issue in the chemistry world at this time that was going on about whether or not analytical chemistry was important, useful, something that should be taught at the undergrad or graduate level, or if this was just Princeton not particularly caring about analytical chemistry.
No, I didn't. I wasn't aware of it so much outside of that.
Okay.
Because the analytical community is so vibrant. I mean, there's PitCon, and there's, you know, and as an analytical faculty member, I can say I have never had any trouble placing students.
Good.
The demand for them is always very, very high. Most of the places where I've taught, there were more analytical applicants for graduate school than there were any of the other divisions.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never really felt that it was unsuccessful or dwindling or, it, you know, in any way in the world not highly successful. It was just... had a Rodney Dangerfield problem in the department.
Were you going to things like PitCon and some of the other national meetings?
Right.
Okay.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. I'd like to pause this for a minute.
Sure.
And I also realized that I,